The Happy Hypocrite, A Fairy Tale for Tired Men by Max Beerbohm. None, it is said, of all who reveled with the regent, was half so wicked as Lord George Hell. I will not trouble my little readers with a long recital of his great naughtiness. But it were well they should know that he was greedy, destructive, and disobedient. I am afraid there is no doubt that he often sat up at Carlton House until long after bedtime, playing at games, and that he generally ate and drank far more than was good for him. His fondness for fine clothes was such that he used to dress on weekdays quite as gorgeously as good people dress on Sundays. He was 35 years old, and a great grief to his parents. And the worst of it was that he set such a bad example to others. Never, never did he try to conceal his wrongdoing, so that in time everyone knew how horrid he was. In fact, I think he was proud of being horrid. Captain Tarleton, in his account of contemporary bucks, suggested that his lordship's great candor was a virtue and should incline us to forgive some of his abominable faults. But, painful as it is to me to dissent from any opinion expressed by one who is now dead, I hold that candor is good only when it reveals good actions or good sentiments, and that when it reveals evil, itself is evil, even also. Lord George Hell did, at last, atone for all his faults, in a way that was never revealed to the world during his lifetime. The reason of his strange and sudden disappearance from that social sphere in which he had so long moved, and never moved again, I will unfold. My little readers will then, I think, acknowledge that any angry judgment they may have passed upon him must be reconsidered, and may be withdrawn. I will leave his lordship in their hands. But my plea for him will not be based upon that candor of his, which some of his friends so much admired. There were, yes, some so weak and so wayward as to think it a fine thing to have an historic title and no scruples. "Here comes George Hell," they would say. "How wicked my lord is looking. Noblesse oblige, you see. And so an aristocrat should be very careful of his good name. Anonymous naughtiness does little harm." It is pleasant to record that many persons were inobnoxious to the magic of his title and disapproved of him so strongly that, whenever he entered a room where they happened to be, they would make straight for the door and watch him very severely through the keyhole. Every morning, when he strolled up Piccadilly, they crossed over to the other side in a compact body, leaving him to the companionship of his bad companions on that which is still called the shady side. Lord George, Greek Sketlios, was quite indifferent to this demonstration. Indeed, he seemed wholly hardened, and when ladies gathered up their skirts as they passed him, he would lightly appraise their ankles. "I am glad I never saw his lordship. They say he was rather like Caligula, with a dash of Sir John Falstaff, and that sometimes on wintry mornings in St. James's Street young children would hush their prattle and cling in disconsolate terror to their nurse's skirts, as they saw him come, that vast and fearful gentleman, with the east wind ruffling the rotund surface of his beaver, ruffling the fur about his neck and wrists, and striking the purple complexion of his cheeks to a still deeper purple. King Bogey, they called him in the nurseries. In the hours when they too were naughty, their nurses would predict his advent down the chimney or from the linen press, and then they always behaved. So that, you see, even the unrighteous are a power for good, in the hands of nurses. It is true that his lordship was a non-smoker. A negative virtue, certainly, and due, even that, I fear, to the fashion of the day, but there the list of his good qualities comes to an abrupt conclusion. He loved with an insatiable love the town and the pleasures of the town, whilst the ennobling influences of our English lakes were quite unknown to him. He used to boast that he had not seen a buttercup for 20 years, and once he called the country a fool's paradise. London was the only place marked on the map of his mind. London gave him all he wished for. Is it not extraordinary to think that he had never spent a happy day nor a day of any kind in Follard Chase, that desirable mansion in Hearts, which he had won from Sir Follard Follard, by a chuck of the dice at Boodle's on his 17th birthday? Always cynical and unkind, he had refused to give the broken baronet his revenge. Always unkind and insolent, he had offered to install him in the lodge, an offer which was, after a little hesitation, accepted. "On my soul, the man's place is a sinecure," Lord George would say. "He never has to open the gate to me. One, so rust has covered the great iron gates of Follard Chase, and moss had covered its paths. The deer browsed upon its terraces. There were only wild flowers anywhere. Deep down among the weeds and water lilies of the little stone-rimmed pond he had looked down upon, lay the marble faun as he had fallen. Of all the sins of his lordship's life, surely not one was more wanton than his neglect of Follard Chase. Some whispered, nor did he ever trouble to deny, that he had won it by foul means, by loaded dice. Indeed, no card player in St. James's cheated more persistently than he. As he was rich and had no wife and family to support, and as his luck was always capital, I can offer no excuse for his conduct. At Carlton House, in the presence of many bishops and cabinet ministers, he once dunned the regent most arrogantly for 5,000 guineas out of which he had cheated him some months before.